Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm speaking to John Sutherland. In the Metropolitan Police for over 25 years, John rose through the ranks to become borough commander for Southwark. He published the book Blue, a memoir, Keeping the Peace and Falling to Pieces, in 2017, which detailed his struggle with mental health whilst working in such an emotionally draining profession. Blue went on to become a Sunday Times top five bestseller. His latest book, Crossing the Line, Lessons from a Life on Duty, invites us to step behind the cordon tape for a closer look at the captivating and eye-opening world of policing. John, thanks so much for talking to us. You begin the book by saying, I want you to see the things that I've seen. It's a very powerful opening. Do you feel that the challenges facing police officers are underestimated?
Absolutely, I do. And that was so much of the reason for writing the book. But it's really important to say it's not that I think people don't care. It's simply that people don't know. Policing inhabits a world that remains so often beyond the view of so many of us. I often talk about the painful privilege of policing, which is to see all of life and all of death and everything in between. And I remember as a serving officer, as the borough commander for Southwark, reviewing daily crime reports and just realizing that things that I was seeing and that my officers were seeing came from a world that remained beyond the view of almost everybody else. And I wondered whether actually I had some sort of a duty to try and tell the people outside of policing about the world that policing reveals.
Because, I mean, we just see it through television shows, really, don't we? How accurate are those?
Well, it depends on which show you're watching, I guess. I mean, you only have to look at the TV schedules or the shelves in the bookshop to realise that people are captivated by policing, both in fact and in fiction. And so we watch dramas and we watch police procedurals and we watch fly-on-the-wall documentaries. I guess it's the factual programmes that are the most accurate.
Now, the killing of George Floyd in the US has really focused attention on law enforcement officials and the allegations of institutional racism. I'd like to know more about your feelings on this.
Well, to begin with George Floyd, I was one of the most heartbreaking and horrifying things to happen in my lifetime. I mean, the footage of his killing I find too traumatic to watch, but I'm aware of the story. I wrote something on a blog a week or so ago, just trying to gather my thoughts on the subject. I mean, the greatest duty, the greatest privilege that any police officer could ever have is to save the life of another human being. And the killing of George Floyd represents an absolute betrayal of everything that I've ever believed in personally and everything that I ever stood for as a police officer.
What would you say about the prevalence of institutional racism within the British police?
It's such a sensitive subject, not helped by the fact that I don't think there's universal agreement on what the term institutional racism means. But I absolutely accept and believe that it's a reality in modern policing and in modern society. Most obviously of all in the structural sense, in the systemic sense. I mean, I remember vividly being a police officer in the Met when the Lawrence Inquiry reported its findings, and they were absolutely damning of the Met. We were accused of being corrupt, we were accused of being incompetent, and we were accused of being institutionally racist. And I remember sitting alone and amongst my colleagues, bewildered and confused and upset and not understanding. And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't think I'm a racist. In fact, I abhor racism, but they appear to be telling me that I am. And policing felt defensive and policing felt wounded. But the point was actually the inquiry panel, I now understand, they weren't talking about me as an individual. They were talking about something much bigger than me. They were talking about a society and a system that repeatedly disadvantages Black and minority ethnic people.
And it is indisputable that young black men are targeted more by the police than any other group in society. Why do you think that is?
Well, I challenge the word targeted, partly because it's a motive and partly because it assumes the motivation on the part of the police. I mean, that absolutely, unequivocally, stop and search figures are disproportionate. But you see that same or comparable disproportionality in almost every aspect of life, most obviously and most currently in the coronavirus death figures, which are another of my current sources of heartbreak. You know, black people in this country are disproportionately more likely to die of coronavirus, as they are disproportionately more likely to be stopped and searched by the police. But they're also disproportionately more likely to live in poor neighbourhoods, to be excluded from education, to suffer from poor mental ill health, to end up in prison. I mean, almost everywhere you look. And I'm so conscious of the fact that I'm a clumsy, middle-aged white bloke talking about these things. But I'm trying to learn, and I'm trying to understand, and I'm trying to educate myself. And, you know, I worked in policing for more than 25 years. And in all of that time, and I don't think I was in denial or I was blind, in all of that time, I only ever saw or heard one overt display of racism from any of my colleagues in more than 25 years. That's not to say that it doesn't exist. It didn't then, it doesn't now. But it is to challenge the perception that it's widespread amongst every individual. Some police officers are racist, as some police officers are criminal. And those individuals have no place in policing. But I can only tell the truth of what I've seen and what I've heard. And for the overwhelming majority of my time in policing, the overwhelming majority of the people that I worked alongside were just about as extraordinary as anyone could ever be. And if you ask the vast majority of them why they joined in the first place, why they want to do the job that they do, they'll tell you really simply that it's because they want to help people.
Now, we've seen many demonstrations and protests, and indeed they're ongoing, around the Black Lives Matter movement. How does the police force decide when to intervene at the possible risk of inflaming matters and when to stand back, as happened recently in Bristol when police allowed a statue to be removed and thrown in the harbour? That must be a very delicate balancing line.
Absolutely. It's. I mean, pick your metaphor. It's a tightrope. It's a balancing act. And often police officers, I think, find themselves a little bit in that damned if you do, damned if you don't world. There have been as many people praising the police commander in Bristol as criticising him for the decision that he took. For what it's worth, I think he took exactly the right decision that was in the interests of both public safety and police officer safety. But it's an incredibly fine balancing act because police officers in public order situations are not there to take sides. They're there to keep order, to maintain the peace, to preserve the rule of law. But they're doing that in an entirely human environment where there are people and emotion and history and feeling and legitimate concern. And the belief that Black Lives Matter is as legitimate as a cause or concern could ever be.
And I mean, just developing that theme, how difficult is it within the police not to be impacted by the anger towards an institution that you're part of, especially if you do understand or even agree with that anger yourself?
It's impossible to ignore it, and it's impossible not to feel it. You know, beneath the uniform, police officers are people just like you and me, with families and concerns and hopes and fears. And, you know, so many of the demonstrations of recent times are in relation to causes that the overwhelming majority of police officers would have absolute sympathy with. The problem comes when a lawless minority take over a righteous cause and begin to commit acts of crime, disorder and violence. But in terms of your question, police officers feel it deeply. You know, as I did when I thought that I was being accused of racism by the Lawrence Inquiry Panel all of those years ago, I care passionately about justice. I care passionately about injustice. In fact, I cared so passionately about those things that I put a uniform on to try and do something about them.
Speaking of lawless elements, what's the dynamic within a demonstration? How do they sometimes go from peaceful to violent? Is it usually outside forces?
Yes, I mean, there are experts with far more knowledge and experience of this than I have, but if I draw a sort of parallel example of the crowds at a football stadium or the crowds at, for example, Notting Hill Carnival, both of which I've dealt with any number of times over the years. It's extraordinary to observe the ways in which crowds can take on a behaviour and a dynamic all of their own, irrespective almost of the wishes of the individuals who make them up. You can have a crowd of 100 people and 98 of them are innocent, peaceful folk, but the actions of one or two can cause panic or can cause sudden movement or can generate the kinds of behaviour that actually decent people want nothing to do with. The demonstrations last week, some of the most powerful images that I saw were of protesters standing between police lines and the lines of those throwing missiles and evidently seeking violence, standing in that gap between the two and saying, no, this is not what we want. This is not what we're here for. And more now than ever, is the time for good people of peace to stand up and make their voices heard passionately and loudly and repeatedly, but peacefully.
In the book, you look at the 10 biggest challenges facing society today, and one of those is domestic violence. Now, there's some pretty horrific statistics coming out about the increase in that during this lockdown period. Can you tell us more?
I've been talking for many years, actually, about domestic violence as a pandemic. It's terrorism on an epic scale. It's a disease of pandemic proportions, and it's the single greatest cause of harm in society, in my view and in my experience. Two women every single week are killed just in this country by their current or former partner. But not just that, a further three women every week take their own lives as a consequence of having suffered from domestic violence. You know, those are recurring figures week on week, year on year. What we found, though, is that lockdown made things even worse. In the first 3 weeks of lockdown in this country, there were more domestic murders than during any comparable three-week period in living memory. Now, it's really important to say that coronavirus doesn't cause domestic violence. There's only one cause of domestic violence, and that's violent people. But what the virus has done is thrown it into even sharper relief. It's made it harder to avoid, harder to hide the reality going on in the lives of some of the most vulnerable people in society. If any Prime Minister or Home Secretary were ever to ask me, and I write this in the book, what crime we should focus on as a society ahead of any other, I would say without hesitation, domestic violence. It's the greatest cause of harm of all.
What are some of the other big problems?
Each chapter in the book tackles a different one. So domestic violence is one, knife crime, drugs, alcohol, terrorism, mental ill health. There's a chapter in the book on police community relations. And what was really interesting to me writing it and thinking about it and having lived a life working on these issues is how many similarities there are between them, and particularly how many similarities there are in sort of between society's failure to respond or deal with them adequately. At the end of the book, I say, really, whether it's domestic violence or knife crime or drugs or alcohol, fundamentally, actually, we know what needs to be done, but we end up not doing it. And for four very simple reasons, and I'll be brief, but by all means ask for more detail if you want it. But number one, we think it's going to cost too much. Number two, we think it's going to take too long. Number three, we think it's going to be too difficult. And number four, for the most part, these crimes, these problems affect people who aren't like you and me. They tend to affect people who are less visible. So I think about knife crime in particular. So many of the victims of knife crime in London are black. And so many of them come from poor neighbourhoods, low-income households. And I do often find myself thinking that had they been children of the establishment, our response to it would have been very different.
You say in the book that police officers in 2020 are operating under greater pressure and strain than at any other point during your lifetime, that in fact these are the most challenging times for policing in this country since the Second World War. Why?
Well, and I wrote that before coronavirus struck, so I guess it's ever more true. But it's for a combination of reasons that make for something of a perfect storm. The first is that over the last 5 years or so, crime has been rising, certainly crime of the most serious kinds. Domestic homicides have been higher than in a long time. Knife crime last year was at its highest on record. So certainly serious crime has been rising. The second reason, though, is that it's not just crime that's been rising, it's demand of every kind. So often police officers are being called upon to fill in the gaps that have been created by cuts to other frontline public services, whether in mental health or adult social care or youth services. Often it's police officers who are left to pick up the pieces. So crime is rising and demand is rising, but complexity is rising too, particularly as a consequence of the rapid, overwhelming advances in technology as an enabler of crime and as an accelerator of harm. And also, fourthly, the risks to police officers are increasing as well. I've seen evidence of more police officers being more seriously assaulted more frequently than at any point I can recall. So all of these things have been on the rise, crime and demand and risk and complexity, at precisely the time where resources have fallen off a cliff edge. Between 2010 and 2018, we lost 44,000 officers and staff from policing in England and Wales alone. I mean, that's a telephone number. And so we're in a situation now where we have fewer people with fewer resources doing a job that's more difficult and often more dangerous than it's ever been before.
John, finally, what needs to be done? What can we as ordinary citizens do to make our neighbourhoods safer and to transform the lives of those less fortunate?
Well, we need to be building bridges, not walls, in both the literal and the metaphorical sense. Policing is at its best when it works in partnership with the community. I always did my job better when I did it alongside the people who lived and worked in the neighbourhoods where I was based. Because actually, when it comes down to it, when you strip away all that really isn't terribly important, it turns out that we want exactly the same things. We want our streets to be safer. We want there to be less violence in the home. We want there to be no violence in the home. We want an end to the endless, grim repetition of the headlines of boys and young men losing their lives. And so it goes on. And the very best way to do that is for police officers and members of the community to stand side by side, hand in hand, working on the things that affect and concern us all.
John, thank you so much. Crossing the Line, Lessons from a Life on Duty by John Sutherland is out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.